Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Education Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. Again, go to the website, TotalTutor.org, to find out more information on Total Education Network. Again, now we're syndicated on 90-plus stations. Go to the website, check it out. Also, in a Berthier College Tutoring and Consulting Company, you can call me at 412-523-0289 for a free phone evaluation of your child. Email me at HaleyTotalTutor.org. Follow me on Twitter at TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley on Facebook. Oh, today was fantastic. Really networking locally in Pittsburgh area. Some big things coming up. Can't wait to talk about all of them, especially the book. And I want to welcome my co-host, Jarrett, to the program. Jarrett, how are you?
Thanks, Neil. Doing very well. Looking forward to what we're going to share with our audience today.
Oh, absolutely. And now we're going to continue on part two of Wraparound. I think we were kind of defining things last week, Jarrett. And now our last segment, and again, if you're listening to the network, you have to go to all the different shows and listen to every show. 8 hours of programming. The Beach Lifestyle adds to the 9 hours of programming that we currently have. I'm in negotiations with 10. So really what we have to do specifically is go back and listen to all the shows to really keep up what's going on. You need to get it in your car and listen to it the entire time. Now, what I was talking about, Jarrett, is specifically enough, just the basics. Now I want to break it down to how we can utilize wraparound services so that it could be successful. A lot of times, and I had a conversation today talking to a family, that they're really, a lot of times, aren't satisfied with their TSS, or they're not satisfied with the treatment plan. So it's my job to go out there and help families in that process, but I want to provide tips today on how to do that.
Well, Neil, that's exactly the line of questioning I was going to start with, and that was what should a family do to make sure they are really using the every component or getting the most usefulness out of wraparound services?
Well, I think the first major thing is you have to be involved in this process. Once the evaluation is done by the team, then you make from the doctor and everybody else, then you and the prescribed amount of treatment is prescribed and the treatment plan is written. You have to make sure that that treatment plan is really there to help your child. If it's not there to help your child, you're in deep trouble in a lot of ways, because why are you going to have, again, as we talked about last segment about this, a family basically being invaded by their people. It doesn't work out. It's a situation where, you know, the TSS or the BSC, I don't want them in my house. Well, if you are going to have them in your house, you want to make sure that there's progress being made.
Right. So, Neil, then the treatment plan, is it looking at one specific area? Let's say, for instance, the treatment plan or the family primarily sees language, oral language usage, as their primary challenge. Would a treatment plan be as simple as focusing only on oral language, or would that end up being one component?
It's going to be one component. You're going to look at a child with autism, and you're going to see a variety of areas where they're not like a regular kid. You're not going to see academic goals, where that's where I come in with my organization, and we'll talk about that at other times. That really, you're going to look at more the therapeutic end of things. You're going to look at the psychology of behavior. You're going to look at specifically socialization goals, many different things involving therapeutic areas to treat the situations and causes of autism. So dieting, all these things can be added to that treatment plan. But the first intake, where, again, the doctor comes with the prescribed, the psychologist or psychiatrist comes out with that prescribed plan, then you have to make sure that everything is followed to a T. And that's the challenge that you have to have as a family going through this. So then the treatment plan's going to be implemented by the TSS, and the BSC's there. You need to work hand in hand with the TSS. You can't say, okay, the TSS is my babysitter now. I'll go ahead and go run a bunch of loads of laundry. And I know families, honestly, I know, as having an autistic child, understanding that how children with autism and their difficulties, that would be really easy to say, man, I finally get a break. No, this is the time that you want them to work themselves out of a job. You don't want to have wraparound services in your house for 10 years. So you want to make sure that they are there to provide the best services possible. So you have to be hand in hand seeing the progress that's being made by the TSS.
Of course. So now I think we're seeing the picture painted here taken for our listeners, and that is these services are intended, if they do last a few years, well, that's okay. But the intention is that the therapeutic services make a difference, that perhaps they won't be needed as much or at all. Is that what we're saying?
I mean, it depends on the severity of the child with autism. If you're mild, at one point in time, wraparound services will never be in your house anymore. All you'll receive is maybe a mobile therapist or some sort of intake at one point in time to, you know, check progress and consult. But at one point in time, it's going to be gone. And here, for our audience out there, wraparound services is only in a few states. And that's going to be part of the roundtable discussion on the Total Education Hour tonight. And I'm going to learn from somebody out in Portland, Oregon, and what areas there are it is located. I understand what's going on in the Pittsburgh area. And I want families out there to understand the success. If you create the team yourself, I could be there to help you in that process. We know that Rodney Peet's wife, Holly, that is, you know, that was a superstar on 21 Jump Street and all that.
Right.
She has a child with autism, and we're really looking to reach out. I'm working with a big organization now. I'll have to talk to you very soon. That's locally in Pittsburgh, but we're trying to build them a national perspective, and they're doing some great things, and they're going to be coming on the Total Education Network very, very soon. But basically, looking at they had to pay for everything themselves. I know they're very wealthy, so it's not a big deal, but there's so many families have to pay out of pocket.
And the
go ahead.
I'm glad you raised that, because that's the question I was really intending to ask here, is who pays for this?
It's the Department of Public Welfare. It's something that this service is provided by the Western Pennsylvania. Some counties, Allegheny County provides it. Other counties in Pennsylvania do provide wraparound services. But it's funded by the Department of Public Welfare.
So let me see if I understand this. So a family with tremendous means, tremendous resources, they would go through the Department of Public Welfare to have wraparound services?
And this is changing. But, yes, it was being done. And now they're trying to change that services where they're going to bill the insurance company. And there's a lot – and co-pays. There's a lot of stuff that was different when I was in the business that I would have to definitely ask some questions for people. But let's continue with the tips. But that's a great point, Jarrett. I think that specifically enough, now there's a big battle going on in PA with Mike Terzai and a lot of different things that, again, my network will be covering, and I'll be learning more about that very, very soon with one of my guests that comes on the show. So, again, the key thing is wraparound services, any type of therapy you have, you need to be hand-in-hand with that therapy. You need to make sure that they're following what needs to be done. So you're seeing what the TSS experience. If they're following the treatment plan, you follow up with the BSC, who is running the team, and say, okay, to the BSC, things are going well, or things aren't going well. And make sure if things aren't going the way you want it and you really don't like what the TSS is doing, to call a meeting as quickly as possible.
What will that meeting achieve?
That meeting will achieve to find out if the TSS is the right fit for the house. And also, specifically enough, is the TSS following what the BSC has set forward? And also the psychiatrist. Are they following what's in the treatment plan? If they're not following what's in the treatment plan, it's a complete waste of time. And I've seen it many, many times happening. So once you see that progress being made, there always are going to be meetings to kind of follow up and check if the objectives have been met. And that's the time, again, to create lots of feedback. And here's the key thing. As a family, you need to take as much documentation as possible. Write things down. Videotape your child. Check it all the different progress, because a lot of times, as quickly as possible, when you go to these meetings, they're looking to take away your services. They're looking to cut your funds. So make sure if you do have a severity that you need that child because that child destroys your house, or really needs those therapeutic services, to make sure you can document that stuff, because that's becoming a big thing now, Jared, as well, to cut it.
Quickly, Neil, tell us, who's the they that would be looking to take away services?
The county. The county's going to look to take away it.
Okay,
plain and simple.
So the Department of Public Welfare?
The service provider, the service the service people that pay for the services, are they have an insurance company that's involved in this, and they're making sure, guess what? These things have to go through. If they're not following correctly, they're going to say, oh, whoa. This isn't working.
Right. So in other words, what I think I hear you saying to our listeners, to me and our listeners, is that there is significant oversight to make sure that the funds are being used properly. Would that
I think it's improved.
Accurate?
I think it's improved, Jared. And I think you would say in your early intervention the same thing. It has improved. Would you agree?
Well, I would say that certainly the oversight has always been good. There is very little waste or fraud in the early intervention program, and if there is, it is caught immediately. There's a number of audits that are really used to control the program. So I think if we took that same approach in other areas, especially if we're going to look at kind of governmental involvement, if they use the same approach used in early intervention, I think oversight would be very strict. Now, that's not to say that the program is looked at to be limited. What I'm saying is that right now there are officials, there are people who are specifically charged with making sure that the service is being provided that is supposed to be provided.
So documentation's key for wraparound as well. Your TSS needs to document everything so that they go to CCBHO, which, again, you're catching me off guard in that specific way, but that's the insurance company that's there to really kind of check out to make sure everything is going right. You have a service coordinator who is appointed that's not from that agency that kind of makes sure everything gets involved. And we can kind of talk about a meeting next time, a treatment plan meeting on our next segment, to talk about specifically understanding the treatment plan, understanding the meeting, understanding who attends the meeting. And I'm going to learn a little bit more about that again, because, again, I've been out of it in a while, that things have changed. And our expert tonight on the Total Education Hour, again, you got to listen to the network every night. Well, I appreciate you calling, Jarrett, and always a great conversation, and look forward to us talking again very soon, okay?
Yep, very good. Wonderful topic.
All right, take care, Jarrett. See ya. Okay.
Bye.
All right, that was Jarrett. You're listening to the Total Education Show on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Education Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. Go to the website, TotalTutor.org, to find out more information on the Total Education Network. Well, always excited to interview people from Inc. Think Tank, especially because I'm a passionate teacher, and finding Vicki Cobb was a godsend, and have such great conversations with the authors, and I missed it. So I said, let's set it back up again. Let's have a series of guests to come on. And our first guest is Barbara Curley. You're the author of the biography John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it doing, Neil?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. And so you're basically a nonfiction children's author. And basically, that kind of define that for our audience, because, again, I'm not, if they listened to Total Education Hour before, they might have missed that point.
Right. So I focus on nonfiction, and my particular interest is picture book biographies. And so I have written about several prominent people, and I think it's a really great way for kids to have history come to life, because they get to know somebody who was a important figure in our past.
And the key thing is that the difference is that you're not like the Dear America series or certain things like that. It's based on pretty much what's going on from the facts, not...
Oh, absolutely. I do a lot of research, and I try as much as possible to use primary sources. And primary sources are things that people actually wrote themselves. So, for instance, when I was working on those Rebels, John and Tom, which has Adams and Jefferson, I looked at Adams' letters, I looked at Jefferson's autobiography. So I looked at the primary sources, the things that those men actually wrote themselves, to try and be as accurate as possible.
And that's so important in the field that you're in. So you kind of wrote about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Through your research, without giving the book away, tell me what types of things did you find when you researched both of the presidents?
Well, I was really interested in Adams and Jefferson because I think more than any other delegates to the Continental Congress, those two really worked together to help bring the delegates toward independence. And what I found so interesting about the two men was they actually were very different. They're very different backgrounds. Adams was a very frugal, hardworking farmer. He did a lot of the work himself on his own farm. Jefferson, as you may know, was running the estate of Monticello, so he had a very aristocratic lifestyle. He had slaves doing the work for him. They came from very, very different backgrounds, and yet when they came to Philadelphia to work at the Continental Congress, they overlooked their differences and worked together.
And that's key, I guess, for us to have what our country is today, if they didn't work together. And I guess different backgrounds from that delegacy, and that's kind of interesting when you were researching that as well, right? The different backgrounds of each one of the men.
Absolutely. You know, we kind of forget now because we've always, in our lifetime, we've had a country with a unified identity. But when the colonies were first established, they were established at different times, and each colony had its own relationship to Great Britain. So when the colonists first came together, they were coming as basically representatives from all these different separate entities trying to come together to create something bigger. And so we don't really remember that now in the same way, but they really had their own interests when they first came to Philadelphia. They had their own interests at heart, and they had to find a way to keep their interests in mind, but also look at the greater good.
Oh, absolutely. The greater good and finding those good things of it. And I think that from that meeting, what kinds of struggles did they go through when they finally met in Philadelphia? They probably traveled from far distances, but also dealt with a lot of, turmoil when they went to Philadelphia.
Exactly. I mean, even basic stuff. They had to basically invent everything. They had to create a way of talking about the big issues. So even before they could discuss, for instance, the independence movement, they had to figure out, how do we vote? Does every colony get one vote, or do bigger colonies get more than one vote? All these really primary, fundamental decisions they had to make, and they had to work together and compromise to do that. And you imagine that kind of depth of discussion and struggle today, it's almost inconceivable that our Congress today would be able to do that level of in-depth discussion and compromise in order to get progress for the country.
Well, talking about our political situation today, this would never happen. Again, because you would say that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had different political ideas as well when they met?
They did. And they actually, when they were in Philadelphia working together, they were much more in line in terms of thinking about the importance of independence. Later on, as they developed their own political philosophies more in more detail in their later years, Adams was very much a strong proponent of a strong central government, and Jefferson was much more of a proponent of states' rights. So over time, they shifted and drifted away from each other, but they were able to forge a bond and a real partnership during the Continental Congress.
Based on their enemy, the British. Their enemy was the British, and that they had to come together to make sure that their rights were not being denied. And that's the
exactly.
key thing. It was the biggest
exactly.
civil rights movement, that event, correct? And the situation of how they were being treated unfairly by the British, that they had to come together so that every walk of life came together at this in Philadelphia to say, we have to make a change, correct?
Right. Correct. And some of the delegates were reluctant. I think the idea of independence appealed to a lot of delegates, but it was a very daunting prospect for these little group of colonists to band together and try and fight Great Britain. I mean, that was the huge, huge naval power. Some people say probably the largest, strongest naval power at that time. So the idea of this little band of colonists could come together and fight this huge opponent was pretty daunting. And so a lot of the delegates, when they got to Philadelphia, even though they liked the idea of independence, they were very, very nervous, reluctant to sign on to actually trying to engage in that struggle.
Because it was treason, correct? So if they did
correct.
That, then they're going to be killed. Pretty much that's what the king would do, right?
Well, if they had not won the fight for independence, all of those men would have been eligible, is the wrong word, probably would have been tried for treason, yes. And some of those men probably would have been hanged. That's correct.
Would have been executed. So, yeah, so the key thing was that they were taking a chance. And also they were taking a chance politically with their influence in their area of the colonies. They had different ideas, different situations. So coming together is so monumental. So through your research, the difficult thing you have to do, Barbara, is it's very, very detailed and difficult to teach this and then to put it in a book so that children relate to it. How do you go about doing that? That's probably the biggest challenge. It's very easy to create a book of research that myself, a historian, could read. But when
right.
we're talking about children, how are you able to do that?
My major philosophy in terms of approaching a new project is, first of all, I need to get to know the people I'm going to write about as well as I can. So I spend a lot of time. I can spend 6 months to a year just doing research before I actually start writing. And I, like I said, I read their diaries and their letters. I read what other people said about them. I read contemporary accounts. I read modern-day accounts. With the hindsight of, you know, we're looking back in history, what do we now understand? I kind of try and read broadly, but also with a lot of detail in terms of their private personal lives. And then I look for things that the kid in me would be interested in. So the kid in me thought it was pretty fun that John Adams used to skip school. I mean, who doesn't love that, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
The president used to play hooky from school. So I tried to include real-life details about the men in a way that would make a kid maybe identify with them a little bit and be interested to learn more about them.
So,
and once I have that foundation started, then I feel like once my readers have gotten to know my character and are rooting for them, basically, then they'll want to follow through on the story and see what happened.
So why did John Adams skip school and play hooky? That's an interesting question because, again, we go back to our education system today with the reformers and all the different things. But thinking about that time, why did John Adams not want to go to school?
Well, during the time when he was playing hooky, he just didn't happen to like his teacher very much. And he really liked being outside. He liked hunting and fishing and walking around in the woods and working on the farm. He liked all of that stuff. And so for that reason, he was constantly skipping school. And later when his father said, you know, John, it would be good if you went to school, and John admitted that he didn't like his teacher very much, he switched schools, and that helped tremendously.
So,
and he became a very avid reader and studier and learner, but in his younger years, he also played a bit of hooky.
So basically, the history's teaching us, basically, that a situation that history repeats itself even in education. Students don't like teachers at a younger age or more interested in being outdoors. And it teaches us as teachers, we need to think out of the box. We got to make learning exciting so that people don't skip school like the president. So that's
exactly.
I wonder how many presidents, here's a good question. How many presidents of the United States have played hooky? That would be a great trivia question. And then for you to research that. There was a guy out there that does a trivia show. It's more of a comedy trivia show, but it would be interesting to hear what kind of answers to those questions would be. So quite interesting. I'm intrigued by this. So what you're trying to do is make it entertaining for the kids, like, because history can be very dry, but by making it entertaining, then what types of kids would be interested in? What age group level for your book would we really want to pick it up and say, this is something cool and I really can relate to it?
Right. So these picture book biographies, I would say probably second grade and up, typically, with kids that have enough reading and sophistication under their belt that they can follow a little bit more of an intricate story than a super young picture book. But second, third, fourth, fifth grade, kind of that age range. By then, kids are getting a really strong sense of themselves and their friends. What does it mean to be a friend? Who am I? They're starting to try and figure out what they like. You know, you ask a kindergartner what they like, they don't know yet. But if you ask a second, third grader, they're starting to get a sense of what's important to them, what they might want to do with their life. I think kids start to think a lot by the time they're in third, fourth, fifth grade about what future do I see for myself. And so I think biographies are a really good fit for that age range because kids are starting to ask those questions.
I think also the creativity of authors like yourself and Vicki Cobb, being able to really bring it to the classroom. And I guess my goal also is to get teachers out there, especially we're teaming up with Carson DeLosa now, and we're reaching out to teachers in that avenue to kind of go to the network as teachers and listen to these programs and say, man, I got to pick up Barbara Curley's book just so I can utilize it when I'm teaching about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson to make the learning more fun. Do you provide any types of lesson plans in the book to kind of do that, or is that more on your website?
Well, I do have teacher activities on my website. I think you're right, though, in terms of my feeling has always been with my biographies that they're an introduction to a topic. Like, you would never go to a picture book biography by me or anyone else and expect to have an exhaustive account of something. It's just not, there's not space for that. But my feeling is if you can get a kid interested, if you can make these people that they're reading about seem like real people that they can relate to, then they're going to want to learn more. And so a lot of teachers, when they use my books, they use them to introduce a topic. For instance, if you were going to study American independence, you might use those rebels, John and Tom, just to introduce the idea of who were some of the people involved in this endeavor and what were some of their concerns and what were these people like. You could use a book like those rebels, John and Tom, to start that discussion and then follow it up with other textbooks and other books as well.
Well, Barbara, I'm so excited because, again, now I'm getting to interview the Ink Think Tank authors, and it's just my passion about what you guys do, because I think that if I was a teacher still, I would really utilize those books to kind of, it's a great supplementary ability to kind of, so we're, you know, that we're so teaching to the test, to have that book out there to kind of intrigue kids to really get them motivated to learn. So Barbara, where can we find more information on you? And there's two websites, right? Ink Think Tank and also your website to purchase the book.
Right. And mine is just, my name is www.barbaracurley.com. And I have information about my books. And I also have a specific section just for teachers that has resources and ideas for the classroom and lots of fun stuff like that.
And in inkthinktank.com, am I correct, or is it .org?
It's a blog spot. If you type in interesting nonfiction for kids, you'll get the blog.
Okay. All right. Well, fantastic. I'll have to make sure I make a note of that. And I appreciate, again, you coming on the program. Love to have you back on again, especially for another book. But I think that you have a series of books you've written in your career. And it was an honor for you to be on the program. And I'm really excited to have this Author's Corner with nonfiction children's authors. It's fantastic. It's a great segment for the Total Education Network. And I appreciate you calling.
Thank you, Neil.
All right, take care now.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right, that was Barbara Curley. You're listening to Total Education Show on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Total Education Network. Now back to the show.